This is Radio Boston. I am Tiziana Deering, and it is President's Day. And what ironic timing. The holiday that was inspired by Washington and Lincoln that embraces U.S. presidents this year falls just 2 days after the second impeachment trial of our last president, which closed with an acquittal on Saturday. So what comes next? An accountability for Donald Trump and on the agenda for President Joe Biden now. Massachusetts Congressman Jake Auchincloss has something to say about it. He is on the line now. Congressman Auchincloss, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good to be with you.
So I have to ask you, we last talked on the fourth Wednesday in January, and you pointed out that your first Wednesday in Congress was an insurrection, the second an impeachment, the third an inauguration. Last Wednesday, you watched an impeachment trial. What does it look like from where you sit today?
Well, I'm gravely disappointed, as I know many of my constituents are, with the Senate GOP failing to do their constitutional duty, really being too scared to do what was right. But we have paths forward, and I want to talk about 14th Amendment Section 3 and what Congress can still do to prohibit President Trump from running for office again. That's an issue of national security, but it's also about representing that nobody is above the law, that there will be consequences for inciting insurrection. We need to pass a joint resolution that lays out the facts of what happened on January 6th, the President Trump's role in it. And of course, the impeachment proceedings have made it easier to lay out those facts. And then concluding that the third section of the 14th Amendment disqualifies President Trump from holding office in the future. And then we also need to pass. Go ahead.
Well, I want to talk more about that. But before we do, can I please pick up on something else you just said? You expressed your disappointment there. And you have said that you expected the acquittal and were nevertheless disappointed. You also, in the last 48 hours, have called it political cowardice. And now you're talking about getting some things passed. And I do wonder what it's like to try to get work done with people you've labeled cowards, especially you're a former Marine. I imagine that word has particular meaning for you.
It does, and I don't use it lightly, and it brings me no pleasure to use it because I am sent to Congress in order to work with people with whom I disagree to get things done. That is there's a long and noble tradition behind vigorous disagreement on policy, and that's totally appropriate. It's what it means to live in a democracy, and I actually welcome that disagreement. I think it makes policy better in the long run. But there are guardrails of democracy beyond which we cannot go and beyond which behavior is unacceptable. And to watch these GOP senators and GOP members of the House who know that what they saw was wrong, who know that what they saw was unconstitutional and impeachable, and yet be too afraid of far-right extremism to take a stand, just really, it undermines confidence in the Constitution and the country.
So then what makes you think that you can get the 14th Amendment joint resolution done?
Well, it's a little bit of math and it's a little bit of politics. The math side of it is that to get this done would require a majority in the House, which we have, and a 60-vote supermajority in the Senate, which is three more than we got for the conviction vote, which is easier than the 10 more that would have been required in the Senate for conviction. So the math's a little bit easier. And then also politically, a censure has less political freight behind it than an impeachment and conviction would have. So it may be easier for those three GOP senators to vote in favor of that and to prohibit Trump from running for office in the future.
You know, I noted that there are varying legal interpretations about the 14th Amendment, whether it applies here, including one interpretation that says it doesn't mention the presidency, so it doesn't apply to the presidency. We just saw an acquittal that was based on a legal interpretation that's considered by at least some to be fringe constitutional law. So do you think you can get agreement on the applicability of the 14th Amendment here to start this process?
Couple of threads in there. So as you said, the argument that the president was not impeachable because he's no longer in office is just absurd. And I think every serious constitutional scholar recognized that it was absurd. And it was a very flimsy shield for senators who were too afraid to do what was right. The 14th Amendment, Section 3, absolutely applies to the president because it applies to anybody who takes an oath to the Constitution. And as we all saw with Joe Biden's inauguration a couple weeks ago, you, of course, take an oath to the Constitution to become president of the United States. So it applies to a president of the United States. Now, having said that, it almost certainly would be challenged in court by the Trump camp. And so This would require both Congress to pass a resolution finding that President Trump violated Section 3, or violated the 14th Amendment, excuse me. And then also it would require the federal judiciary to step in and protect the Constitution as well. I'll add that there is a second parallel track here for Congress, which is to pass targeted enforcement legislation, which would contain the same set of facts about how President Trump violated the 14th Amendment by inciting insurrection, and then also permitting the Attorney General to bring a court action to obtain a judgment that Section 3 of the 14th Amendment bars President Trump from holding office in the future. And that is not inconsistent with the first action. It's just more targeted. And this is a good opportunity for me to call out here an organization called Protect Democracy. It can be found at protectdemocracy.org. I'm proud to say that they're based in my district. And they are a group of former executive branch attorneys who are committed to upholding the Constitution and who have done really terrific work on the 14th Amendment for listeners who are interested.
So this would all be with an eye towards keeping the president from running for office again. I don't like to pick up on trolling, but I do have to note the Boston Herald's reporting that Steve Bannon spoke to a group of Boston Republicans over the weekend and laid out a vision where the former president runs for Congress in 2022, runs for Speaker, then launches impeachment proceedings against the current president, Joe Biden, for stealing the election. And then that's a path to running again in 2024. Is that trolling, or are you concerned that if you can't get this done, that's where the Republican Party is going to go?
I mean, I'm not going to engage with Steve Bannon's just performative extremism. What I want to be very clear about, though, is that these efforts are not political. They're constitutional in nature. And what I mean by that is I'm not invoking the 14th Amendment here because I disagree with President Trump's policies. I do. I think he was a terrible president, but that's not a constitutional reason to prohibit someone from running for office again. This is about his violation of the Constitution, specifically his incitement of insurrection. And if we as a country are going to be a government of laws, then we need to establish the precedent that anybody, even the president of the United States, is subject to that law and that there are consequences for breaking it.
So you, over the last 48 hours, seem to have really been holding two things in two hands. One is this 14th Amendment. The other is your focus on what you have repeatedly termed crushing the coronavirus. One of the concerns about going through another Senate impeachment trial was potentially derailing the Biden administration's agenda, which includes this nearly $2 trillion bill. Trial's over. Is it time for the bill? Can it get done? Where is your sense of urgency? Not like it's missing, but what do you feel most urgent about there, and what happens next?
Well, Congress can absolutely do two things at once. We can hold the worst president in history accountable for violating the Constitution, and we can handle the greatest natural disaster in a century. I spent all last week on committee hearings about this American Rescue Plan, making sure that we were getting money for vaccine production, for reopening the schools, for helping restaurants that are in dire straits. So Americans should absolutely expect and even demand that Congress do two things at once right now. Certainly most American families have been. I think we need to make handling COVID the absolute priority of the foreseeable future. Until this is behind us, this has to be priority number 1A. I know it's President Biden's priority. It's certainly my priority. Insofar as there is any reservoir of this virus anywhere in the world, it's a threat for a new variant that is not addressable by the existing vaccinations, and thereby it's a ticking time bomb for another pandemic. So shots in arms needs to be the order of the day for so long as there are unvaccinated populations anywhere.
Do you think kids should be in person in schools now? You mentioned getting Americans back in schools.
One of the great tragedies of this pandemic has been the loss of in-person learning. We know that remote learning is not adequately meeting the needs of students, parents, or teachers. We know that there has been disproportionate impact on low-income families, on communities of color, in terms of how far behind kids have fallen in literacy and numeracy and pro-sociality. It's a tragedy. And getting kids back to in-person learning is a matter of education. It's a matter of equity. It's a matter of the economy. We need to do that as soon as safely possible. I've been working very hard in the district to expand surveillance testing to that end. We need to upgrade HVAC in the schools. We need to vaccinate teachers. and we need to get kids back into seats ASAP.
So the Commonwealth is supporting this, or the Baker administration is supporting this bill, supporting another $1.9 trillion. There was Boston Globe reporting that actually the Commonwealth hasn't spent a significant chunk of the money we already have. I'm sure that's true for other states as well. Some $1 billion in federal stimulus cash here in Massachusetts is not yet spent. Given concerns about deficit spending, that if you spend $2 trillion here, what do you do with infrastructure later, for example? How do you balance that with the idea that the Commonwealth hasn't even spent yet what it's got?
Well, there's a deep reservoir of need. The cost of expanding educational programming to make up for what has been lost, of upgrades to HVAC, of testing for students and teachers for the near future, all of this costs real money, and all of this requires federal relief. And let's also keep in mind that local and state budgets are lagging indicators of recessions and tough times. So FY 2021, 2022 are likely going to be even tougher than the previous fiscal year was, and they're going to need that federal support. I'm a strong supporter of making this federal relief relatively elastic in how it can be used. I think states and cities and nonprofits and families and businesses are better judges of how they can use the money than the federal government is. And so I have no problem with it being fungible across time and across uses, but we know there's going to be a reservoir of need, and we need to get that relief to people ASAP.
So you're comfortable with the size, the timing, the pace of what's being proposed, despite concerns about how it's going to affect the economy and the fact that there might be the need for it to follow the Democratic agenda, big spending in the future on things like infrastructure, green energy?
We need to go big and go fast. There is the acute need for money to increase vaccination supply and vaccination distribution. And every hour that we are not spending money on that is potentially lost time in this race between vaccinations and variants. And then we know that there is the need for these dollars from all the participants in the economy right now. And I have great confidence that it's going to be spent in ways that are going to prevent scarring of the labor force by keeping people out of work, and ways that improve our productivity and allow us to rebound faster in the next six months to a year.
I know you've been very focused on the logistics of getting more vaccines out, produced and distributed. When do you think we're going to see a point of equilibrium where the supply can meet the demand?
I think it's going to be getting better and better over the spring and the summer. We're already seeing it get better under President Biden's leadership over the last few weeks here. The key is going to be not just using the Defense Production Act to produce more of the kind of complementary supplies to vaccinations, but it's also going to be approving new vaccinations and then catalyzing the partnerships within industry between those companies that have manufacturing bandwidth but no vaccine and those companies that have vaccines but not enough manufacturing bandwidth. If we can do those two things, approve more vaccines, get them online, and then have companies kind of pitch in to help with manufacturing, even if they don't have a vaccine themselves, we're going to have a lot of vaccinations over the course of the next 12 months. And we're going to need them all because, like I said, we cannot allow any reservoirs of this virus to be existing anywhere in the world, or it's a threat to all of us.
Okay, so with that in mind, when do you think your constituents will live a life that is not completely dominated by this pandemic? Is there some time frame in your head where you see that light?
So I think of it less in terms of a generic back to normal and more sort of sector by sector. And I can say that I am absolutely committed and focused on full in-person learning by September and significant and substantive improvements this spring as well. I don't want to make it seem like we're going to stay on the status quo right now. But by September, by the next school year, every kid full-time in-person learning, I think, just needs to be the rallying cry. And so much of the rest of the economy is predicated on that being realizable.
All right. That is Congressman Jake Auchincloss, who represents the 4th Massachusetts District. Thanks for coming back to the show, Congressman.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And it is President's Day, and I think we are all considering the state of the presidency right now after the Senate acquitted former President Donald Trump Saturday on a charge of inciting an insurrection. So 7 Republican senators voted to convict, but it seemed like there were more surprises in the speeches made after the vote than in the vote itself. And we have heard so many people in our lives in the last 48 hours ask, what is the point? So we want to talk about that. We're inviting your calls. What is the point? In the trial, the outcome, what comes next? How are you feeling about it today? Did this latest impeachment trial, which is the second in about a year, erode your trust in institutions? Does it change how you see the presidency? Call us. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can send us a tweet at Radio Boston. So to have this conversation, we decided to ask back the same two people who joined us the day after the attempted insurrection to reflect on it. They give us kind of this sense of then and now. So we have David Gergen, who has advised four U.S. presidents, Nixon, Ford, Reagan, Clinton. He's also the founding director of the Center for Public Leadership at the Harvard Kennedy School, where he's a professor. Also Kelly Carter Jackson, who is an assistant professor of Africana Studies at Wellesley College. David and Kelly, welcome back.
Hi, thank you for having me again.
So, David, I'm going to ask you both the same question. David, I'll have you go first. What was, in your mind, the point of the trial last week, and did the Senate accomplish whatever that point was?
I think that the whole trial was actually a very, very good idea. It turned out better than I expected. I think, most importantly, it gave the American people a very real sense, graphic sense, of the near catastrophe that occurred on Capitol Hill, just how heinous this assault was, and just the brutality of the people who were participating, the leaders of the assault. I think the pictures we saw, the way Jamie Raskin and his colleagues laid out the case, I thought made a very deep impression on people who watched and listened about just how dangerous and how close to the edge we became. I mean, to have the very idea that the Vice President of the United States was like 60 steps away from a mob and had to be rushed out, and they were yelling "hang him," and they had a noose and a hangman's place up outside on the Capitol. They literally might have hung him. Think about Mitt Romney, who, he was saved by one of the Capitol policemen, a man of great integrity, who helped him spirit away. So I thought, if you can go down the list like that, Nancy Pelosi and how close she came, how they were trying to single her out, that I think will live with us for a long time. I also think, very importantly, Tiziana, this sealed the fate of Donald Trump. I think after this
you think
final,
it did?
I do. I believe that Republicans know that, and they're going to try to head him off at the pass so he's not their next nominee in 2024. I do not think he will be their nominee in 2024 because I think the backlash is going to be sufficient that others are going to – they're going to see him as a he'll take them down to defeat. While Donald Trump has been in office, what happened? They lost the White House, the House, and the Senate. Is this really somebody you want to put back in who's been impeached twice and who was did indeed encourage that mob? Whether you call that incitement is a legal issue, but to have him go down in history, I think Jake Auchincloss was right about this. He's been a terrible president, and I think it will be well understood. He was certainly one of our worst, and if not the worst president in our history, and we were darn lucky we didn't have a catastrophe on January 6th with that mob.
So Kelly Carter Jackson, let me just invite you to weigh in on the same questions.
Man, I can't agree more with so many of the things that David said. Watching the footage was gripping, and seeing it again from different angles or different perspectives, and how each senator gave such a provocative, emotional rendition of what happened from their own perspective. I think that was incredibly powerful. And I was really proud of the way that the impeachment trial proceeded and all of the information, the way they presented the facts of the case, I thought was so compelling. But the outcome, I think, was also very predictable in a lot of ways. We knew that people were going to vote along party lines and that there wasn't going to be that much divergence. And I think that is what saddens me the most, the complete or collective cowardice-ness of the Republican Party to be able to call a spade and to see the evidence, to hear the evidence, and to dismiss it and to ignore it. There are certain Republican senators that were you know, sketching, doodling. Rand Paul was doodling. Other senators were reading, you know, books that are completely unrelated during the proceedings. The lack of, like, respect and care that I saw for people's lives being at risk. Five people died. And just the lack of compassion or even call to rational thinking, I thought was just, I mean, it was a little grotesque, to say the least. So I don't know what I can say about Trump going forward. I have not completely written him off. I do think that if he doesn't become, you know, another elected official again, I think he can definitely has the reins to become a kingmaker in a lot of ways. And I think we saw that, you know, reflected in the vote and the fact that people were unwilling to vote against his interests in something, you know, like this impeachment trial.
So I'm going to go to calls. I just want to note five people died in the events immediately associated with the insurrection. And then after the fact, two more died from suicide. So I think we're at seven in total. Let me go to the phones. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's get a couple caller voices here. Let's start with Ben in Alton Bay. Ben, go ahead.
Hello. I just wanted to say that I think that although the trial was probably not necessary, I think it was good because the Republicans did bring out the point that it would be unconstitutional to impeach based upon the Constitution. It would be inappropriate. So I think it was a good decision, as much as Trump may have been involved and may have spurred on. And I think the point of Trump's lawyers that really over the past 6 months, the Democratic senators and others who have been spurring on the rioters and the protesters and encouraging looting and rioting really also encouraged this insurrection. And so I think it's been a terrible thing, but I think the Constitution was upheld, and I think we'll avoid finding Trump guilty, I think we'll avoid going back and having impeachment trials for Hillary Clinton and for Kamala Harris and for others who are involved in similar things. So,
Thanks, Ben. I'm going to take Jack now from Groton. Jack.
Hi, thanks. So you asked what it meant to people. To me, it was useful and meaningful to have this trial. It documented these things for history, which I think is going to be valuable, hopefully at some point. It also demonstrated a few things. It demonstrated the willingness of people to hide behind meaningless shells like the constitutionality issue in order to keep themselves whole in order to get reelected or for other personal reasons. But more than anything, I think it documented the impact that Donald Trump has had on our country. The number of people who still believe that he should have been found innocent here, and the number of senators and congressional leaders willing to support him nonetheless. This is a pathetic documentation of the impact that Donald Trump has had on our country.
Jack, thanks for that call. So David Gergen, right there in Ben and Jack, there it is, the microcosm of where we are as a country.
That's very true. I happen to agree more with Jack on some things. I can understand where Ben is coming from on the constitutional argument and having that settled in a vote. That you know, it was the right thing to do to put it up for the vote, even though I disagreed with the outcome. But I particularly agree with Jack that it really displayed who Donald Trump is and who the Republican Party is. I said it sealed the fate a moment ago, sealed the fate of Donald Trump in the future. I also think it sealed the fate, Tatiana, of the radicalism that has grown up in the Republican Party. This party cannot return to what it needs to be, and that is a center-right party, not a radical party. It needs to be and the country needs a center-right party, just as we need a center-left party. That's what gives us dynamism. When I was in the White House, we used to talk about the two parties playing on a football field, and the entire play took place between the 40-yard lines. So people were sort of bunched in that center where things worked out. And I think the Republicans have gone too far in sort of, you know, kissing the ring of Donald Trump again and again and enabling him. They've been enablers all the way through this, that he has been able to inject this big lie into our national conversation that Joe Biden is not a legitimate president. And that's just false. It's how Hitler came to power, on a big lie. And I think that big lie has increasingly been exposed to what it is.
So let me turn to you, Kelly Carter Jackson. And of course, when you have great guests, there's 700 things you want to talk about, which there are several in what David just said. But before we go back to the 700 things, I do want to give you a chance too, Kelly Carter Jackson. Ben talked about Democrats in the last 6 months supporting rioting and looting. You have done extensive writing on how we frame Black protest and who has the right to protest in this country. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to miss the chance to give you a chance to address what Ben said in his call.
Yeah, you know, we have talked about this before, and that we have two different narratives. We have two completely different narratives that are being presented through the media, in which people have one idea about what the Black Lives Matter protests look like, what they meant to them. And then there's a completely different alternative narrative of the Black Lives Matter as being almost like a terroristic group. And so I think, you know, this double standard in how we have interpreted or misinterpreted Black Lives Matter, their call for liberation, their push for equal justice, and might I add, their very real grievances. I mean, Black Lives Matter is in response to police brutality, to the death of countless men and women. And when we think about, you know, what it was that the men and women that stormed the Capitol were angry about, was just not true, that the election was stolen, was just not true. And you can't tether it to any grievance that bears, you know, legitimacy or even truth to it. And I think those are the things that we really have to ask ourselves. What are the people involved in Black Lives Matter pushing for? And what are people on the other side pushing for? And when we think about how many people have died trying to bring about justice, trying to bring about things like equality and equity and accountability, you know, it just, you can't have a discussion, a real, you know, I think rich discussion about how this will play out if you cannot agree on the facts and you cannot agree on, you know, the things that we all see in front of us. I think everyone sees two different things, and just finding common ground on that truth has just been so incredibly difficult to have. I'm not sure how to reconcile this, because, you know, we can disagree about a lot of things, but when it comes to Black humanity, I can't compromise on that. I can't say Black people are three-fifths a person, let's compromise. Like, and I think that that's what a lot of these grievances are about, not being willing to accept the ugliness of white supremacy.
All right. Again, 700 things there, too. I'm going to bring a caller voice in, and then I'm going to go back on a couple of things you've both said. We've got Pamela on the line from Concord. Pamela, go ahead.
Oh, hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I watched every single bit of the trial. Having been a trial lawyer for many years, I thought the trial team put together, I'll give them an A+. It was really fantastic. I wasn't surprised at the failure to convict. I mean, we've had 4 years of basically an assault on decency, an assault on democracy, an assault on dignity, and an assault on the truth. If the Republicans as a group never spoke up when he tore small brown children from their parents at the border, if they never spoke up when he tried to extort the democratically elected leader of a fledgling democracy, then I did not think they would stand up when he tried to overthrow the United States government. You know, the reason he didn't raise a defense, he didn't have one. He didn't have one. But having said all that, and I'm still just so horrified by it, having said all that, I'm so glad we had the trial. I was not surprised at the verdict. And the reason I'm glad is because there's a record. There is a bulletproof record of the American carnage that this clown visited upon us. And history will not forget.
Thank you for that, Pamela. And we hear the fierceness, David Gergen, in Pamela's argument. And I wanted to get her call in because you had said you really do believe this is it, not only for Donald Trump, but for Trumpism. And certainly you hear someone like Pamela, and that makes sense. But I think about Lindsey Graham saying, we got to keep this MAGA thing going. And Kevin McCarthy going down to Mar-a-Lago and having lunch with Donald Trump. And I want to say, David, do we think it's really over? I mean, where are you getting that optimism from?
No, I think this. Trump is gone. Trumpism is still here. But I think it's going to be a diminishing force over time. You know, the mainstream media is not going to continue giving Donald Trump as much attention as it has in the past. He's already lost his Twitter account. He's lost his way on social media. Now he's going to the cameras are going to go elsewhere, and we're going to move from this being Trump being today's story to yesterday's story. Meanwhile, people are going to be asking about what's Joe Biden up to. Let's turn to the future. And I don't think I think it doesn't make any sense to be relitigating the Trump stuff again and again and again. That's why I have real qualms about what the congressman was saying here, Auchincloss, because you know he wants to bring it back up again. I think now we need to give Joe Biden a chance to govern and deal with the big issues, and let Trump fade into the rearview mirror for a while. And I think
so. You would not support the 14th Amendment pursuit, then, David? Is that what you're saying?
I would be very much in favor of a 9/11 type commission to get more facts, to get the historical record as straight as possible. There may be things there that would lead to more proceedings, criminal proceedings or whatever. But on the record we have now, going to the 14th Amendment just seems like it has a quality. You know, we've done this twice now. If we just keep on trying to beat up and find some way to put Trump in jail, you know, until then we're not going to be satisfied. I don't think that's productive for the Democrats. I'm reminded there's an old Churchill line that if we let the past dominate the present, we will lose the future. And I think that's very much where we are as a people right now, that we do need at some point to move on and let Trump go away, just encourage him just to go away. There are going to be people, his advocates, you know, the strong people have been around him and love him as a cult figure. They're going to continue to be there. We'll continue to hear from them. But I think they've reached the apogee of what they can do in this society. I think right now they're going to be rejected by an awful lot of decent people who say, you know, that's just too far. When you start going in and trying to murder people or trying to hang them, you know, it's just American people are going to find it disgusting. There's a reason that Biden is around 60% in the polls and Trump is around 40%.
So Kelly Carter Jackson, and this is what David just said is something that actually came up when we all talked on January 7th as well, mm-hmm. which is where is the balance of the country? You know, you expressed some strong feelings that those who were in the Capitol on the January 6th did not have legitimate grievances, mm-hmm. and that there was a denial that black claims and Black Lives Matter. I want to both challenge that a little in, is it not possible that there could be those who supported the president who do have other grievances? And if there are other grievances, now that's different than buying the big lie, and I want to be very clear about that. If mm-hmm. there are, and if, as David Gergen says, there is some horizon here where we could find common ground, how to carry forward the agenda that you are passionate about and build some kind of new coalition that moves our country beyond Donald Trump.
Man, I would love to see that. I would love to be optimistic. I would love to think that as all Americans that we have a shared interest in our democracy. We have a shared interest in making sure that everyone has access to good health care and a good education and shelter and food and water and all of the things that we believe are part of life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness. I would love to believe that, but I'm constantly reminded of the people that stormed the Capitol. I'm constantly reminded of those graphic images and how, and we've talked about this before, how non-fringe those people were, how there's an Olympic athlete, how there were veterans, how there were, you know, ministers made up of that group. And I think this is the America that we have to contend with, not just these radical, like militia, you know, right wing extremists, but the people who are our neighbors. And finding that common ground, I think, is going to be incredibly difficult, because in a lot of ways we've seen that even with Trump gone, the conspiracy theories, they continue, they evolve, they pivot, and then pinpoint something else to latch onto in order to create this continued momentum of fear and anxiety about, like, you know, social and political displacement. And I don't have I don't have solutions. I don't have answers to how to address that, because I feel like oftentimes my solutions of what I see as equality or equity, others see as robbery to their identity and to their political power. And I don't know how to reconcile that.
Well, we are going to keep this conversation going. I'd like to go to a break in a minute. Before I do, I'll take a couple of calls here, and we invite you to join this conversation. It's our first chance as a Radio Boston community to reflect on the events of the last 5 or 6 days and the verdict in the Senate trial on Saturday. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's hear from Mary in Braintree. Mary.
Hi. Yes, I think the recent events in Washington have pointed out the need for congressional term limits. Too many of them care only about getting reelected, not adherence to the Constitution and what's best for the country. Maybe the first step is to get rid of their pensions and lifelong health care. It's a first step.
All right. And let's take one more before the break. Jarrett in Malden. Jarrett, go ahead.
Hi. First-time caller, long-time listener. I love this show.
Thanks, Jarrett.
I want to, no problem. I listen every day, and I know this is a very important topic, so I'll just be very short and succinct. I'm a man of color. I'm 44 years old, and I have two little boys. And what I saw happen in the Capitol is absolutely disgusting. And the fact that we know, based on, like, real empirical data, like, we all saw it. It wasn't a mass delusion that this man stoked the fire in these people who we already knew, which the young woman said that this is not a fringe group. We already knew that they had hate in their heart. And so it's not like if this was a business, we would call an HR. You know, we would call an HR and say, hey, we have a problem with this guy, blah, 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 blah. And what happens, we find the same things that are found within commerce, that there are old boy groups, affinity groups, and they can say and do what they will. And it sickens me because we all know what's right. And if we don't know what's right, then I have no problem having that discussion. But at the same time, we know this guy was horrible for the economy, for everything in America, and he stoked up all of us. And so, like, as a citizen, as an independent, not somebody who's a Democrat or Republican, I'm sick by seeing these old, and I'll say it very bluntly, old white men who are like old boys clubs who will vote for each other and get each other out of trouble. And that's what it seems like. That's totally
all right, Jarrett, I'm gonna take it from you there.
Yeah.
Thank you for the call, Jarrett. I want us to go to a break. Kelly Carter-Jackson, David Gergen, callers, stay with us. On this Monday, President's Day, we are going to continue a thumping conversation between two guests, David Gergen, advisor to four U.S. presidents and the founding director of the Center for Public Leadership at Harvard, and Kelly Carter-Jackson, an assistant professor of Africana Studies at Wellesley College. And you're calling in like crazy. It's our first chance as a Radio Boston community to react to the results of the Senate impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. To join this conversation, I'll pick up a couple more calls in a second, but David Gergen, Kelly Carter-Jackson, I do want to begin now as we move towards the end of the show to also start talking about what this means for our faith in our democratic institutions and our ability to move forward. Kelly Carter-Jackson, I think I'll turn to you first. Do the events of last week strengthen our faith in our institutions, weaken them, or are we just at status quo?
Well, if you're Black, this is status quo. And I hate to say that, but the same feeling that Black people have every single time a police officer is acquitted for the murder and for the death of a Black people, that gut wrenching feeling, is the same thing I imagine that a lot of white Americans have felt at the acquittal of President Trump. This unaccountability and the feeling as though justice has really been miscarried in this moment. So I think a lot of Black people are sort of counseling their white friends, like, yeah, this is how it feels. It sucks to feel this way. But I hope that going forward, that one of the things that I think this trial did so well was that it was able to show so clearly not just the things that were criminal about President Trump, but the things that are so harmful that if we stay in this direction, maybe crimes aren't necessarily committed, but the harm that is being done to American people, to American democracy, the Constitution, that has to be protected at all costs. And whether we got an acquittal or not, you know, that's a victory to be delayed. But at the same time, I think we have moved ourselves a little bit closer about what are the things that are really harming us as Americans.
So David Gergen, to that point, according to NPR last Friday, there had been more than 230 arrests in the follow-up. The Senate, even some Republican senators, talked about the possibility of criminal prosecution for Donald Trump. We know there's an investigation in Georgia over the possibility that he tampered with the election there. How important, to Kelly Carter Jackson's point and to this broader question of faith in our institutions, how important is a vigorous set of criminal prosecutions now? Or is it too little, too late? Oh, did we lose David Gergen? I think we might have lost David there. Kelly Carter Jackson, do I still have you?
Yes, I'm still here.
Okay. I think they're going to try to get David Gergen back. But in the meantime, I'm going to ask you the same question. And you can okay. You can answer it yourself. And then we'll go to a couple of calls.
I mean, I do think that we should continue to push for justice. I mean, I know that New York State also has, you know, is making a case against Donald Trump. And I hope that he will be held accountable. I think so many people just want a lot of these wrongs to be righted and to be addressed and for someone to be prosecuted. You know, when I think about the hundreds of people that stormed the Capitol, I want them to be prosecuted. I want them to face real jail time and real penalty. Because if there's no penalty for killing people, for harming people, for destroying the Capitol, for destroying federal property, then what's to stop the next act from happening? What is to deter? Where's the real deterrent if no one is held accountable? These are things we have to be mindful of. These are things we have to pursue, regardless of whether it's popular or not. It's what's right.
Let me grab a couple more calls here. We've got Dale on the line from Lexington. Dale, go ahead.
Yeah, hi, good afternoon. One understands that Mitch McConnell is probably not too happy with having been reduced from his omnipotence as the head honcho in the Senate. Yet my problem with his comment after the vote was admitted about the impeachment was that he explained his vote on the basis of his understanding of the unconstitutionality of the process of impeachment and having the impeachment trial. And my understanding was that that decision had been settled by a majority vote prior to the actual substance of the trial taking place, and that the trial would proceed, and that decision was made. So my question is whether or not he was derelict in his responsibility as a juror when he explained his reason for his vote as, you know, having been that issue of his understanding of the unconstitutionality. And also whether
Dale, so actually I'm going to take it back from you there, Dale, because that's a good question. Sorry to cut you off. I'm always mindful of time towards the end of the show. David Gergen, we have you back. Maybe I can have you respond to Dale.
Sure, and it's good. It's a good question. I think the situation is even worse than it looks with regard to this issue, and that is that it was up to McConnell when to start this trial. And he purposely withheld action, stopped action on the trial, until basically Trump had left office. And then having, you know, turned it that way, he had a convenient excuse. He invented this technicality that it once the president leaves office, you can't go after him. So this was all contrived in a very serious way. I want to make one other point, if I might. About what happens to Trump as we go forward. I think it's really important for the country that whatever happened, we not do it with, you know, trying to do everything we can to clap this guy into jail. What we need are fair proceedings. We don't need aggressive, overly aggressive law. His people deserve to walk out of this. If we ever want peace with his base, to if it looks like he's been hustled into jail on some phony charges, I think that's going to be highly destructive. You know, we really need a chance to move on in this country. I do want to say one last thing, if I might, Tiziana, and that is this whole episode on the assault so exposed the hypocrisy of Donald Trump and the fiendish nature of Donald Trump. You know, he spent his last 3 or 4 years telling us he's a law and order president, and he loves the cops. He thinks they do wonderful things. Yet when it served his interest to cling to power, what did he do? He set this assault up to beat up on the cops, to, you know, to savage them, to kill some of them. They lost their eye. A guy lost his eye. A guy, you know, one guy had a heart attack. People died from all of this. And he was taking pleasure in it, watching from the White House. That is fiendish.
So we do not have time to go to the phones one more time, but I was marked or struck by a call from Shana in Cambridge who wanted to know if this is what it looks like to have a minority rule country, which is provocative looking forward. Kelly Carter Jackson, in a few sentences, your reaction to Shana's question.
I'm not exactly sure if we have experienced a minority rule, but I can say that I'm encouraged to see someone like Kamala Harris. I'm encouraged to see more and more women, and in particular women of color, take up political spaces. I'm encouraged to see Georgia and their two Democratic senators of African American descent and Jewish American descent. I'm excited to see a country that is so much more inclusive at a political level. That excites me. Now, whether we can sustain this and whether it becomes the pattern going forward or the routine or the status quo going forward, I think remains to be seen. But we're at the cusp of something different, and that's really exciting.
All right. And David Gergen, back to you. Last, 30, 45 seconds or so, do you share a sense of hope? I heard real hope from Kelly Carter Jackson there. I heard inspiration.
Yes. I have a sense of hope. I think we have a new administration that is pledged to diversity, that is pledged to equal opportunity. I think that they're quite sincere about it. The appointments that reflect that diversity, we've never seen as many people of color, as many women in powerful positions as we do today. And he's very low-key about it. There's a humility and a decency we've talked about here on the show before, Tiziana. So all of that gives me hope. But I'll tell you what else gives me hope. I've talked to some CEOs recently who have said there's been a market change in the way that young people are coming looking for jobs these days. They want to know, before they go to work for you in a company, is your company doing good things in the world? It's increasingly about more than making money for these young people. They also want to see changes in the country, and I think that's one of our great hopes.
Excellent. Well, that is David Gergen and Kelly Carter Jackson. David Gergen advised 4 U.S. presidents and is a professor at the Harvard Kennedy School. Kelly Carter Jackson is assistant professor of Africana Studies at Wellesley College. You two never disappoint. Thank you so much for coming back a month later and looping back around with us here on Radio Boston. Thank you.
You're terrific, Tiziana. Take care, Kelly.
Thank you, you too.
Great to have you both. And that is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks so much for listening today. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.